Go around the room and introduce ourselves. I'm Chuck Riley, Associate Provost.
Mike Johnson, Provost.
Winston Schoenfeld, Interim Vice President for Research.
Lilo Hernandez, Associate Dean of Research and Innovation.
Hi, I'm Briannis. I'm the Abbott Assistant for Chuck and Charlie.
Lee Ross, Full Professor, Community College of Innovation and Education, Department of Criminal Justice.
Dan Edens, Associate Professor at Leadership Higher Education.
Shelley Part, Full Professor, Philosophy and Cultural Studies.
Claudia Shippert with SCH, so you can track that.
Yeah.
Philosophy Department, Associate Professor of Humanities and Cultural Studies.
Robert Castanello, President of UF at UCF, affectionately known in the press as the First Amendment Knight.
Craig Novick, Associate General Counsel.
Charlie Piper, Director, CCAS.
Jayla Jasinski, Vice Provost for Faculty Excellence.
Gerald Hector, Senior Vice President for Administration and Finance.
Well, thank you everyone for being here this morning. We have five questions that the UFF has sent to us that we're going to address this morning. Gerald Hector and Winston Schoenfeld are going to take the first one, so I'm going to ask that you present the question, and these will be the gentlemen that will respond.
Sure, great. You might have the benefit of maybe not having been here when the whole rollout stuff happened, since you're new, but maybe not. But the first question is really about the problems encountered with Workday, and also in as far as it affects members of our bargaining unit, right? The increased time that we have to spend entering information about anything from travel procedures to grants. I am in the philosophy department. We, I guess, luckily don't have a lot of huge grants, but I hear from my colleagues who RPIs on lots of grants that it's a lot of work. So some concerns that have been brought to us and that I wanted to raise is that, of course, before the rollout, as you might remember, for almost a year, we got emails that Workday is coming in. It's probably going to be a mess. So we apologize in advance. So that is a new strategy for UCF, right? Usually we just roll out things that don't work, and then we apologize later. So this was good. We knew it was going to be difficult. But at the same time, at least in my college, there was also reorganization of staff, right? So this has created a lot of problems for a lot of faculty, because the people responsible for helping us with this are responsible for more people. They're no longer in departments, and faculty have to do a lot of additional work that is really not related to what our assignments are, right? I'm pretty good with these kind of technologies, so I tend to work my way through it, but it's a lot of time, right? Some for travel, reimbursements, for grants, et cetera. And of course, I'm not technically trained to do that. And so the concerns we have are, one, about workload and about the added responsibility that is put on faculty and professional staff, because it's not really part of our assignment. I doubt I can put it down under my service. It's not really part of the work that goes towards producing new knowledge. It disincentivizes, frankly, at least for those of us who can't afford to do so, actually declaring our travel. Particularly since we don't get a lot of travel reimbursements anyway, which in turn invites a lot of problems with liability concerns. Right? Liability concerns might also be there because we're not technically trained. I mean, we were trained, you know, by 100 reminder emails about how to do Workday, but there are a lot of details to grant management, to travel procedures that come with some liability, or at least come with non-compliance in terms of getting reimbursements, getting the grants through. So these are all concerns that are about workload, that are about responsibility, that are in addition to whether Workday actually works or doesn't. Those were some things that we wanted to bring to the table. So how are you addressing these kind of concerns in this context? And if that's not clear, please ask me.
No, it is very clear, and thank you. This is my first in higher ed attending one of these bargaining sessions. So,
we're not bargaining.
Yes, it's not bargaining.
Our meeting session here, and every word that comes up is almost, I feel as if I'm just trying to prepare for this meeting. So I'm going to be as who I am, as Gerald Hector. And quite frankly, everything you've said is spot on. I don't disagree with anything there. I will tell you that we are looking at that very issue. Two things come to mind that I will say. One is where we're headed is definitely going to be much better. However, in the interim, what we're trying to do is to bring 13 colleges and several departments that have been so disparate over the years that we have manually done everything. So we're trying to get everybody onto one platform. So Workday gets us to that. Right now we have an issue, quite frankly, around training. The other issue that I would say around the administrative units, we have moved to what's called shared services. Mm-hmm. And the reason why we made that move to shared services is that we realized that even though departments had individuals resident in those areas, the work still was not getting done in a way that was smooth, right? And also, we talk about compliance and things of that nature, liability. What we're also now learning is folks in the center just basically did the work. So there is no SMEs or subject matter experts, if you will, throughout the organization. So everything we did prior, or majority of things we did prior, was done via paper. Either something was handed to someone, they signed it, it went somewhere, it went into a process, and eventually it got done. So what we're trying to do is to streamline all of those processes. Now, what has been very, very interesting to watch as we bring everybody together is who did what and how was it accomplished? And basically how it was being accomplished was through emails, PDFs, we know about the labors, we know about timesheets, all those things. All of that has been automated right now. Where we are seeing gaps is gaps in knowledge. So for example, policy, procedures, and things like that. So those are the issues. How are we going to solve them? We are looking into what's called delegations to see if delegations will allow for what we used to do with paper, we can do with the system, meaning that if someone had someone down the hall who they used to sign a piece of paper and hand it to, delegate to that individual, and that individual can utilize it in Workday such that faculty don't have to do that. And try to mimic as much as possible the paper moving that we had before. So that's what we're working on right now. We're dealing with that and also trying to get training done in a way that individuals understand how things were done prior, how things need to be done, and just improve upon that process. The time to hire is one of it, for example. We've heard from the faculty on that. I am meeting with the Research Council. I meet Linda Walters, her group, and also I'm in close contact with Dr. Stephen King, and we are working on a process of how we can communicate back to faculty the changes that we've made. We have a listing from the faculty that I'm actively working on, and we're basically putting them into project sprints. So as soon as we solve an issue for the faculty, we check it off and we're going to communicate. So that is something you'll be hearing more about. But some of the issues we have right now is all of the growing pains of change in an organization that has been so decentralized over the years that we just did not have what I would consider guardrails that everyone lives by. The last thing that I would mention, you mentioned liability. That is something that we're concerned about as well. As we look at who has the subject matter expertise to address some of these things, we're realizing that there are also gaps there as well. So what we have done over the years is we've relied on a small group of people to basically be the policemen or policewomen for things getting done right, be it compliance in officer research, be it in travel, things of that nature. And quite frankly, we're pretty much not surprised, but we see where training opportunities exist. You know, people like the questions folks are asking, even the folks that used to just shepherd the paper around, it's now becoming clear they didn't really know why they were shepherding it around. They just knew something needed to be done. So we are going to be very focused on professional development, not only in the center, but throughout the university, on things that are necessary, ordinary and necessary, to run this enterprise in a different way. So we are actively engaged with faculty through Dr. King and the Faculty Research Council. I've been to several meetings, Academic Leadership Academy. I just presented to them. And I'll continue to present to faculty groups as much as possible. But it is something that is a heavy lift. And it's a lift that in many ways was overdue, depending on how we have set our systems up back in 2004. And now we're just trying to modernize the way we do things so we can run the university in a way that is more transparent and accountability is brought to bear. So that's how I can respond to those issues now. We are aware of it. We are on top of it. Spend quite a bit of time with the research folks. And I'll be more than happy to answer any other questions if I didn't make any sense.
I wanted to just, it's actually very helpful that you're talking about it sort of as a, how does the system work or doesn't, and how is it improved. I guess one note that I didn't have my glasses on, so I didn't see, I wanted to make about the labor, for example, right? I mean, one big change from the perspective of us is that we now see everybody else's labor. I can see who in my unit has filed a labor, and I think that's kind of a problem. So the issue in terms of accountability also brings some issues in terms of surveillance and in terms of privacy and these sort of things. You may want to look into that.
Yep.
We had some issues with file sharing in the system that we had, you know, earlier a couple of years ago. The fact that I can see who has filed a labor in my unit is, I think, not necessary for a faculty person. So you may want to consider that.
Thank you.
And the other thing is, I appreciate the, just as a follow-up, I appreciate the concern that you want to get everybody online and stop the paper pushing and have people who are knowledgeable to do that. That's good, wonderful. From the perspective of faculty, there has been, at this point, unless that's going to change, a real downloading of some of the workload. Mm-hmm. Right? So we did not have to do a number of things that enabled us to do our work. Primarily research, also some teaching, but certainly research of various kinds. And although I understand you want the systems to function better, I think what we're concerned with is that a significant part of the work is being now going to be done by faculty, and faculty are not compensated, or we're not accounted, it's not accounted for in our workload, right?
Yeah. Sure, I want to comment on workload.
Yeah.
Just no argument about it. That's where we are today. We knew, as you saw in the emails that came out before this, that there's this startup period that we're still in. Part of what gets straightened out is configuration. So the comment about seeing timesheets sounds like a configuration issue to me. Part of it is like business processes. So, you know, we're heading towards a point where the faculty are supposed to get adequately supported by, for example, the college business units. And that's going to take a while to shake out. There's a, you know, the training of the staff in the central, in the college or in unit, business units is continuing. Part of a next week meeting is going to be talking about what's the appropriate way to support faculty on initiating things, for example. And what I don't know is where we're going to end up, right? We might end up where it's a little bit similar to the past, where you ask somebody to do something by some mechanism, or it might end up where certain things really are remaining in the hands of faculty. And the analogy I would make is, you know, I became a faculty member in 1990. There were still people in my department at the time who needed secretarial support to type their tests and letters and papers that they wrote and things like that. And I sort of scoffed at it because I'd come in on the leading edge of people having their hands on their own keyboards. And I don't know how much of this is going to end up, all of us, with a certain amount more. It has to be easy or it's not going to be acceptable. There may be some, but all I can really tell you is Cheryl and his team completely agree that right now it's a lot of work and they're working hard to try to rationalize it. You know, keep asking, keep pushing, because we'll know better as the months go on how well we're either simplifying what we are asking faculty to do or giving adequate support for the things that aren't really very simplifiable.
And I'll just piggyback on one thing Mike said there. One of the things that we're also seeing, we're going to have to find a happy medium somewhere, because some faculty members want that level of interaction and some don't. But we can't tailor how the system, we have to get into a flow so we can get things moving. And what we have done historically is adjust to how people want things done. So this might not mean anything to you, but when we looked in the system before we converted, we had well over 9,000 accounts. We are now down to 1,000, which is more manageable. But how we got to the 9,000 is everyone that wants a little thing done, we allowed for it to be in the system. That makes the systems unwieldy. And how do we bring some commonality there? Those are some of the things that we're trying to work through now. And as the service centers get ramped up and people get educated, who do we delegate to? So the folks that were in the departments in the units, they basically were just moved into a central area so we could take advantage of economies of scale. So not only that, when you talk to the budget directors now, even without the moving of the personnel or not, just a new system to get us in a process flow that removes the manual stuff, it would have been very difficult for them to manage the system. So we're putting all of that in context on how we can make this efficient, so we're taking the administrative burden away from the faculty. But we are actively working on that right now.
A follow-up question. You mentioned an interest in hiring to promote professional development. And I'm wondering, given the current budget situation with our institution, where they got to give back money, a lot of colleges to give back money, that's over budget, if you will, how does that affect your long-range plan?
Well, we're looking at train-the-trainer. I've done it elsewhere before. It's less expensive. And quite frankly, what we are seeing right now, we have people that have been hired here. For example, Kathleen Winningham used to do this at Disney. She is the person that runs Next. She did the entire professional development or some aspects of it for Disney. And she basically joined us at UCF, so we're very pleased about that. She's leading our Next group. So herself, myself, Mr. White, our controller, we've been talking about how do we get individuals understanding what is happening, because they have never been exposed to this before, because they've always just done the paper. The University of Washington State University did a very good thing that we're looking into, and is that actually the folks that are touching everything, it's just taken through basic accounting courses. And that worked very well for them, and they're 2 years in. And there are other institutions that we can look at as well. UVA went live with us on July 1st. They took a different approach, but they're having their growing pains as well. Ohio State, LSU, they've all gone through this. We're just three and a half months in. But for some of them, it took them 6 months to a year to sort out. So we're right in that sweet spot. But, you know, as the provost just said, the growing pains are real. But like I share with folks, we had to tackle some of these things if we're really going to meet some of the strategic objectives that the president and the board has laid out.
I got to ask, because yeah. I flinched when I heard it. You're not talking about accounting classes for your faculty now, are you?
Oh, no, not for the faculty.
No, it's not the faculty.
Not the faculty. No, not the faculty.
I would have.
My mother was an accountant. She made a lot more money than I did.
That's right. That's right.
I wanted to go that route.
That's right. But if I just a matter of just being very clear with everyone here, I am personally actively engaged with a number of faculty groups, and I speak to faculty that are impacted right now personally and walking them through some of their issues. I can tell you a lot of it is right now is around training and information sharing, and how do we get everybody to see what it is. Now, we do have some faculty, I'm told, they're not even getting into Workday at all. They don't want to touch it, they don't want to get into it. I understand that, that's fine. But we will continue to provide and be accessible and provide feedback and open the loops, close the loops, but also at the same time to all explain in very granular details why we made the moves that we had to move. We are an institution that's $2.2 billion and we grew very fast. And the systems on which we built that is what we're trying to lay a foundation that growth can continue. Right now, it shifts depending on what happens in a given year. And I know we are on the right path. And we're joining all of our other Research One institutions that have gone this road before and have successfully been utilizing the system with great skill, and it has been a benefit to them. So we'll be there, but it's going to just take this constant engagement and making sure that you keep us accountable as well by asking the tough questions.
So if we have some like notes we want to send to someone, like for example, why am I getting a reminder email to enter my time off, even though I'm not an hourly employee every week?
Yeah.
Should I just email you, or what's the best contact?
We've been working through Dr. King. King has been doing that. Actually, I have a list right now that he has shared with me. It's about 13 pages long.
Yeah, that sounds right.
Yeah. But when we look at it, it's the same thing that's coming up. For example, the punch out comes up a lot. I can tell you that we're also looking at the levels of review. And quite frankly, people ask me, is there anything that you would want to take back? I would say yes. I think we have to trust people more. And when we look at some of the layers that we have put in and how the routing, depending on what college it was, they wanted people to see things at multiple steps. So what I've been advocating is, if you got to touch a transaction more than 3 times, that's too much. But in our world, in our current culture, the provost has to see it, the CFO has to see it, the department chair has to see it, and the dean has to see it. Mm-hmm. And then it goes over to next, and then it touches it again and again. So I'm advocating now that no more than 3 touches. That brings up the liability issue in some ways. But I believe if we properly invest in our people and we train them on what needs to be done, we can do it. And that is what we're, because that cuts down on the emails and the things that are coming our way.
For time's sake, I will spare you the story of how many emails it took and how long it took for me to get a webcam in my office, but it was many and long, so
okay.
I won't give you the details.
Thank you.
So if that's okay, we can move to the second question. And you probably noticed that a number of our issues are about...
I'd just like to thank Mr.
Hector. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes,
sorry.
Please.
I have to run to Tampa.
Go fix some problems.
Please don't run. Do you take your vehicle?
Yeah.
It's a long run. It's a long run.
Yes, I am driving. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure meeting some of you. I've never met some of you before.
Nice to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
All right, no worries.
Thanks so much.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
So the second question, as I was going to say, a lot of the questions that we're asking here, not surprisingly, have to do with issues of morale, with issues of frustrations with systems, with the current situation, with the world we live in, and how it affects our work here. So we had asked, in the broadest sense, about some data about faculty retention. It's certainly anecdotally true for many of us that we know many people who have left UCF, and that we're also having a really hard time recruiting faculty to UCF. Not all of that is the fault of UCF, but also of the state of Florida, of course. And so we wanted to learn a little bit more about what do we actually have in terms of data. And Jenna sent some numbers that went from 2016 to 2021. They were not super fine, you know, in terms of retention. So, you know, roughly, but we know some rough stuff. But it would be probably useful to know a little bit more about how are we actually doing in terms of recruitment and retention, particularly of women and faculty of color? And then what do we know about people who are leaving? For example, is there something, like I'd ask for some, you know, cumulative data from exit interviews, for example. Do we have any sense, do you have any sense, what UCF could do to keep people here who are good? Or to attract people who are choosing not to stay or not to come here. Because certainly it's all of our interest to have a stable faculty of highly qualified people who are desirable and not just the bottom of the barrel or the ones who got stuck here and can't get out. So what do we have in terms of data from exit interviews? What are the efforts that you are actively already engaged in or are anticipating?
Let me start. All right, let me start with the exit interviews. We don't have good data because we don't have centralized exit interviews today. The Senate passed a resolution, I want to say it was last spring, or maybe off on the day, that said we'd love to have a centralized exit thing. And we said, great, have you met Workday and Night Vision? So it is on the plan. The provost signed off on it. We just haven't been able to get with HR to find a way to make this happen.
So thus far, we really have no exit interviews. We have no idea why people are leaving, right?
We have what HR, central HR does, which is
Okay.
Hey, employee, for all employees, would you like to do this survey? Very few faculty, as I understand it, even acknowledge it exists. So I would say we have anecdotal data on why people leave. A couple years ago, I asked all the deans about their tenured and tenure-earning faculty why they left. And at that point, the reasons were varied. Some included things like they moved on to a different kind of job, like moving to a leadership position somewhere else, like a dean or associate dean. Some were moving to being closer to family. Some were not progressing towards tenure. So a whole variety of things. Some were money. It was all over the place. But that, again, is still sort of anecdotal, not more systematic.
And also, one thing I think that it might come up later, while that's really important to understand that for tenuring tenure faculty, of course, we have a majority of our faculty now in contingent positions that, and they often get like not included in a lot of these surveys for just, I guess, traditional reasons. I think it would be really important to also understand why folks in more vulnerable non-tenure positions are leaving, and especially because I think the gender makeup and perhaps also the racial ethnic makeup there might be somewhat different. Yeah.
If we can get the centralized exit interview process working, it would be for any faculty leaving.
Okay.
It would.
But Jana, that doesn't sound like Workday to me.
Yeah. Oh no, it has to do with the people, the person resources available to dedicate to this to get it working.
Okay.
So it's not that the system can't do it, but we need people to get it moving in a systematic way.
They're so focused on trying to fix.
But I also don't think it's central HR that should be conducting these interviews, right?
It wasn't that they would do interviews. It's what the Senate asked for was a more detailed survey that's different than the current survey, which is administered by HR.
Okay.
So to work through them, no, I agree. I would prefer to have a role in that process, to be completely transparent. But I need to work with them to make it work as part of their exit process.
I know that when I was dean in sciences, we tried to do exit interviews, at least in the college, for faculty who departed. It was all ranks. And we didn't succeed very well, just because people didn't come in, right? We would invite to talk confidentially to an associate dean about, you know, just to find out for the same reasons you're interested. So we've never had, I didn't have good luck figuring out how to get the information. I think the exit interviews, which is kind of what you focused on here, if you can get them, feel like the best way to get some sense of problems more than a survey,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, if there's a personnel problem in a department or whatever, it's really hard to find that from a survey. But I did struggle with that, and I'm not certain if their universities are doing a good job, do you know, of getting people to come in, not just trying.
The examples I've seen, which came primarily from the, there was a subcommittee of the, it was the personnel committee, the Senate subcommittee, went out and did some research and
mm-hmm.
some legwork, and most of those were pretty extensive surveys of the universities that did it. They called them interviews, but they really were not interviews in the sense of talking to somebody. It was really more of a survey. If I find out if someone's leaving, I will reach out and say, I'm happy to have a conversation, even after you leave, and I've done that on occasion. And what I typically say is, you know, you don't need to give me any names. I need to know if there's something we could have done to keep you, and did we push you out, or were you pulled out, or what's going on? And I don't have any good systematic information about that. The ones I've talked to are, well, you know, I want to be close to my partner, family, whatever, or I realized I really want to be more of a teaching institution, not whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
not, and they're infrequent. So your first question here asked about numbers. I want to say it was spring of 2020, but I may be off of my time. I've lost all sense of years now. We did a presentation for the Board of Trustees where we did a 10-year look back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sorry, I forgot to bring the link. We can get the link to Charlie to get to you. Our numbers of faculty leaving were actually decreasing over time.
This was when, in 2020?
I think it was spring of 2020. It's in their minutes of the Board of Trustees, but I'll find it.
The interesting stuff's going to be... after that.
And
right?
I don't have what I have, what we gave to you now for the total numbers is what I have now because the numbers are updated every fall.
Yeah.
So they will update in November, but I don't think I'll have anything until December.
And those will be the numbers for the previous year, right?
Yeah, from fall of 21 to fall of 22.
Okay. Yeah.
So that would be that.
I mean, I think it absolutely would be great to have better data and definitely exit interviews to see what best practices are somewhere else to get meaningful information for everyone involved. And I also think we're just faced with a lot of challenges that neither side really can do much about in terms of this not being the state people want to move to, particular people. And so there might, you know, that there might be other ways to address some of those things that don't have anything to do with that. But I think minimally having that data is really, really important.
Oh, I agree. I'm a fan of data. You also asked about what we were doing to recruit faculty. Also, because I'm forgetting timeline, it was virtual, so it had to be during the pandemic. So Faculty Excellence has had historically now 3 Inclusive Excellence Faculty Fellows, and 2 of them worked on an Inclusive Excellence Faculty Hiring Toolkit, and we did a roadshow of sorts to all the colleges with the deans and the chairs to talk through. The toolkit's still available on our website. How can you recruit in an inclusive fashion? How can you think about all your processes, starting with your ad, being inviting, being inclusive, and thinking about how you welcome different individuals to campus? So that is something that's out there. The Office of Institutional Equity also has resources for more inclusive recruitment. Coach data will show you that these, although they're helpful to have these things, what really matters is the culture and climate of the unit. So we don't have a whole lot of influence over what happens in the unit, but those are some things we can do. If there are other things we can do, I'm open to learning about other ideas. That's what we have done now, is to think about how we can do a better job recruiting faculty and bringing them to do more inclusive interviews. So small things matter in that, I find.
Yeah, more inclusive interviews are great if you have more diverse faculty to have the interviews, but if you don't, then yeah. So we'll probably talk about that more a little bit later, but I agree with all the things that you're saying. Are there any other things about the numbers or data that we want to address right now?
I have a follow-up question.
I would just say, could we get the data?
when
you have the new data, could you share it with us?
Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah, this is either for Jenna or for Dr. Johnson. When people leave the university and they get, let's say, offers, sometimes the university makes efforts to retain them. They make like a counter offer. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the process of how that occurs? Because some people leave, and some people, well, they leave because they're not given a counter offer, mm-hmm. an opportunity to stay, mm-hmm. and other people are given the opportunity to stay by getting some type of counter offer. Can you explain the process of how that develops or unfolds?
Do you mean the mechanics, or do you mean
the step-by-step. Well, someone got an offer, we called them in, we talked to them.
I mean, I can say a little bit about it, because this is largely driven at the college and department level. Usually somebody gives the institution a chance to counter, not always. Sometimes they're just ready to go. They'll talk to the chair, they'll explain what's going on. The chair talks to the dean, and it's usually at that level where they decide, are they going to make efforts to try to retain this person? And ADI is the tool which is most useful to retain faculty who are seeking to depart. Mm-hmm. So discretionary raises. And that can be constrained by a college budget. It's not very often that somebody wants something else as a reason to stay. They won't normally say, I want a different teaching load, I want a different assignment associated with research. It's nearly always about money, if we have a chance to keep them. And so, we got some modest success with that. My own sense has always been that there's 2 cases where we don't really have a chance. One is where somebody has really decided and they're just kind of giving us a courtesy. And the other, and that's for lots of reasons. I mean, the ones that I've always used to kid about is that when they're going back home, you never win. Meaning if it's back to family, back to their undergraduate institution, something like that. Occasionally, this is more like in fields like medicine or engineering, sometimes the amount that it would be necessary to counter is beyond our capacity to even consider. And in those cases, we don't usually give a ridiculously lowball counter. But just wish them well. But it's very seldom that it comes into Jana or me for a real decision. What they do have to do, and this is back to the mechanics, is as you know, there's limited reasons that ADIs can be offered, and so you should explain it.
They have to write a reason and explain, and if it's a counteroffer, we ask to see it to make sure it's actually a real counteroffer.
Mm-hmm. And when you say they, you mean the college?
The college provides, yeah. So we're just looking to see that, Dr. So-and-so said they have an offer from someplace. Okay, can we see it just to make sure it's a real thing? And not just,
it has to be a verified written offer.
Right.
Yeah.
I guess I'm surprised that you're not the final decision maker.
Yeah, but I think deans and chairs should be. I mean, they manage their budgets. They understand the value of the faculty members that they have in their department or college. I'm occasionally asked to help, but that's really rare. And I don't want to make that kind of decision. If I thought, I mean, because you asked the question, I now wonder, should I be? And I should be if there's a dean in particular who's not adequately trying to retain faculty that they should try to retain. That would be a problem for us.
Right. I know with the emeritus status situation, the president is the ultimate decision maker. It goes up to the president. So suddenly I was...
So,
same type of
we sign off on them. It requires approval, but that's not the same thing as butting in and trying to change a decision. Because, in fact, I wouldn't even hear about it unless they're seeking to make the counter under ordinary circumstances, or actually if the counter's been accepted, probably.
Yeah.
They don't. The deans don't tend to come to me to ask, may I make a counter? And it's like, that's their job, is to decide when they should do that, working with their chairs. I have to sign off on it, but that's, and in my opinion, that's a formal signing off, meaning ensure that the policies have been adhered to and all of that.
But Claudia, you asked about retention. I think a key part of that is for chairs to have communication with their faculty to know what's going on, because as the provost mentioned, it's not helpful if they've already accepted a job somewhere else and they're just saying, here, I mean, maybe they want to leave, we can't stop them, but if there's communication going on before that, they might have prevented them from looking for the job in the first place, potentially. But I also know our chairs have limited bandwidth because some of them have a lot of faculty, so there's that.
But it's a good question, Jana. Mm-hmm. Just when Leah asked that question, it's like, oh, it's another one of those little flinches. I think we should, it would be useful for me to see when you look at the data again, with the new data and the old data, and understand it by college, and at the same time, see if we can decorate it with some sense of what ADIs, or what, in particular, what counteroffer ADIs have taken place in colleges over these few years, because it would be a concern if it turned out some college was happy to let people go a little too frequently. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would have noticed that the way our system works.
Right. Right.
Well, and my guess would be, right, that the colleges that have the lowest budgets to work with intersect with the colleges that have the most female and faculty of color.
That's a good question. You know, when I was dean, science was always at the bottom, for example, below arts and humanities, down with Rosen. But things have changed a little bit since then. It's really budget per faculty, which is a better measure of that. I hear you. When your budget's squeezed, it's harder to do counters. Okay. On the other hand, the deans also know market goes up and up. Costs money to bring in new people. Might have to pay more for a replacement than the amount
someone
you would add to it to keep someone. So it is a hard budget walk.
Good.
One thing I'd like to add, since one of the things that came up was this idea of surveys and how it would be good to get information from the faculty that are leaving. I think this is something where we could really work together on that. You know, if we're somehow administering an exit survey at the university level, if faculty groups like yourself would also encourage people, you ought to let the university know that this helps all of us in the long run, and it isn't just us. You know, if somebody gets a call, you know, I want to go see the provost or the vice provost to talk, I may not be so inclined to do that. But if I say one of my friends in the union suggested I do this, maybe they'll
do
that.
We tend to encourage people to let you know
why
they're leaving. So.
I'll talk to anybody. I mean, really.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's important information. And
I think the trouble is when they're happy, they're more likely to, but we want to hear from the ones that are not happy, right?
That's right.
The negatives are always more useful than...
But it's always voluntary, right? Like you turn in your keys, there's a checklist of things you have to do, but then exit interview is voluntary. You know,
I think that's part of the exit checklist now is the, here's the HR survey.
We won't stop paying you unless...
It's like, you're not going to fill it out or you will.
Well, I'm leaving.
Yeah, get some interesting responses.
One more survey. Okay, well, if we can move on, to the third question, which is, I guess, perhaps also to Jan? I don't know. This is a little bit specific, perhaps, it's an example. As we are having more and more instructor lecturers in each of the units, there's also increasingly more responsibility sometimes being taken on by lecturers, for example, in directing programs or doing other administrative things. And so I was wondering, and the way I guess the question was phrased, is what is there a policy on the level of the university? The answer is probably no. Or what is the guidance that you give to deans who hopefully have a policy at the level of the college about how appropriate it is or how to compensate or accommodate contingent faculty being placed in positions of administrative responsibility? Now, I'm not sure it's the wisest thing to do, to put somebody who is non-tenure earning and is on a lecture position in a role where they have to assert certain pressure on people who are have power over them or who are higher in the hierarchy, but it happens, right? And so the question is how, and of course also often those kind of positions, at least in the cases I'm familiar with, are taken up by tenure earning, by non-tenure earning faculty because of a perception that they don't really have the power to say no, right? The contingent faculty position is contingent. And as is made clear at various turns, lecturers and instructors can be let go at any time with pretty much no reason. I know that's not really what the contract says, but that's essentially how it functions. So if somebody is asked by a director or a chair, do you want to direct this program, they may not feel like they're in a position to say no, even if they get no course release or no compensation or stipend for it. So in some cases there are stipends, in some cases there are compensations. My question really is not so much about the philosophy of is this useful or not, but what is the university policy around this? Is there guidance to how colleges are supposed to, or deans are supposed to, direct the chairs in various units regarding this kind of responsibility and compensation? Is the question clear?
I think so. Yeah. There's no policy that I'm aware of at the university. Where I can tell you I see this is when departments do their bylaws, because they'll talk about committees and who's the leader of the committee. So it might be an undergraduate committee and the undergraduate program director is the leader. Well, how does that person, who gets in that role, what's the responsibility, and what's the, you use the word compensation, whatever the benefits are for being in that. I think most commonly I see in the bylaws people talking about course releases because it's free, cheap, I don't know, that's what I used to see.
Just time.
Time, it's time, yeah, thank you. But there's no university policy, and typically if a bylaw comes through us, that's the one question I always ask is, who gets on the committee, how do they get there, and what does this person get for doing these things? That's usually the sort of cut, paste, repeat kind of question.
Right. Yeah.
Typically where I see instructors and lecturers is in that role of undergraduate program director. Although I understand more recently there's a lecturer who is the Women's Studies Program Director, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see them as often in other kinds of things.
I think that's my impression as well, the positions, which are actually, as you all know, probably with the increasing number of surveys and assessment visits, is quite a lot of work. And I don't know. Course release is what you see happening. You see course release happening at any particular interval, or does it vary in your impression?
It varies, and it varies based upon the size of the unit sometimes. Mm-hmm. So the larger ones, larger units sometimes have multiple people. So they might have a person who's the general education, if they're a large general education department person, or they might have an overall undergraduate coordinator, or I've also seen a separate assessment coordinator. So some departments, depending on how much the work goes, break it up into different people.
And that makes sense. I mean, one program might have 50 majors and one might have 500, and obviously you have to have different kind of
companies. So it does vary.
Yeah.
So there is, that's what you see, but there is no policy, and there's no guidance to deans to develop policies about this, or?
Not that I'm aware of, other than they should have their own policies in their college.
So I guess part of what we're trying to do here is to signal to you that it might be a really good idea to think about giving some guidance, particularly as the numbers of those folks, the instructor and lecturers, are increasing and the responsibilities heaped upon them, because many of the tenure earning or tenured faculty might say, I'm not going to do that. And then people in the more contingent roles will say, okay, I'll do that. So there are some dynamics of power and exploitation that are real, and that can, some of that is a systemic larger issue, but some of them can certainly begin to be addressed by talking to the deans about some uniformity at least, so that there is a clear expectation on the part for that would be a goal, one goal, for faculty to have an understanding that if their teaching load is 4-4, they can't also be asked to direct 4 programs and write 3 assessment reports. I mean, I would have to see the ASAPs that can make that work, right? But it happens. So I think it's something that would be good to provide some guidance to the colleges for.
Do you have a feel for numbers right now? Is it a small number of people at this point, and you're just thinking of worrying about the trajectory, or do we currently have a real issue?
Well, I mean, what do you mean by numbers? I mean, there are a lot of instructors and lecturers who are doing these sort of things. Now, I don't know in each of the cases how that's worked out in their unit, right? But I certainly know from a number of people that the way it's worked out is not very satisfactory to them, and it's uneven.
Okay.
And it often depends on the goodwill of communication between supervisors and not. And that's what I'm saying, that's just not a good way to go when the power differentials are so big, to depend on the goodwill of a chair or a director. But to have some guidance from the larger structures would be very helpful there. I mean, obviously you can't say you direct a program, you get a course release, because they're different programs.
They could go into bylaws that explain, everyone knows, and transparency bylaws could say, this is how we function as a department.
Yes.
I actually speak to people who are impacted by this, and unfortunately all of the people I've spoken to never wanted to disclose who they are, so I never reached out to Chuck or Charlie or anyone like that to try and resolve these situations, but I do hear from them. And what Claudia is saying is very true, especially those who are not only lecturers but instructors who tell me, you know, I get into a meeting, I'm dealing with an associate dean, and I'm told, do you want to be director of X or coordinator of Y or what have you? And I don't have the information to know what I can negotiate. I don't know what my limits are. I don't know what I could ask for. And I feel intimidated, first of all, to say yes for the reasons that Claudia just mentioned. But also, they don't know the span of options, you know, and so when they reach out to me, they've already agreed, and I'm just going to be honest here, and you know, they've agreed to a shitty deal, because you know the power dynamics that Claudia mentioned is so inherent to someone who is contingent faculty that they think that, oh, this is they're giving me the best I can get. I can't ask for a course release, or I can't ask for a stipend, or I can't, and they don't realize there are these options and that they can negotiate. They have the power to negotiate. And in each of these cases, I always say, do you want me to bring this up to somebody? Do you want me to talk to somebody? And we say, no, I don't want to be non-reappointed. So they understand, you know, the atmosphere in which, you know, that they exist. And I know, I think this is what Claudia is saying and what we've talked about before, but, you know, if they had the information about what their possibilities are, you know, they might be able to go into these meetings with associate deans or deans and be able to not to feel that they were taken advantage of. Because when it gets to me, that's what I hear. I hear I've been taken advantage of, but I don't want to be fired, and I don't want, you know, this or that, you know, and they get like, you know, crumbs to do something that's, quite frankly, a pretty tall task for someone who's an instructor lecturer.
And I think in general, I think it's probably a good idea not to trust the good character of unit leaders to be the guarantee to do this. If that works out that way, that's fine. But directors and chairs are also under a lot of pressure, right? And so in a lot of contexts, they will take a deal that's good for them and for the unit, but might not be so great for the particular faculty member. And so there are lots of dynamics there that could be helped by just having a more transparent communication on the college level, at least.
Robert, your examples were deans and associate deans. Does that mean they were not for duties in the unit? They were at the larger...
Well, pressed so hard for identification.
I've heard both cases.
Because your examples were more local and yours were different. That's
right.
What I'm trying to reconcile.
And sometimes the units are like really structured, right? So you have,
Right. Right. So I've heard cases where it was a college position and when it was in unit.
Okay, I'm trying to reconcile where the education might be needed.
So there are some colleges where it just doesn't work out.
The common denominator, I think, is it's at the dean level, right? Because, you have these instructor lecturers who, are sort of on the rank frontier, if you will, right? They're dealing with the associate dean whom they're never even supposed to contact directly, right? And there is that very real imbalance that Claudia is mentioning, and I think... there probably should be some intervention done on the part of the administration to inform the person who is negotiating their future in this position, what they're in store for and what their options are. Because they definitely, at least the ones that contact me, they definitely didn't know. And again, they don't feel, they feel cheated, if you will. They feel bullied. Almost, in some cases, I think, and I don't know that's the intent of the college or the associate dean or what have you. I don't know what their intention were, but I'm sure, UCF doesn't want an employee to come away from one of these experiences thinking, I had very few options and I got bullied into this thing. I'm regretting, right? Well, that certainly doesn't make.
I was concerned about the retaliation piece. They may not always be sharing all the information with you, and vice versa, right? So, I mean, I understand that.
Well, I mean, I get the ADIs. I see the data, and when someone's going through a college and they say, "Oh, I'm told that no one gets an ADI in my college," and I said, "Well, I can tell you for a fact that is wrong." Mm-hmm. I don't think they're making that up.
No, I understand that.
So, I guess my. Just final observation here would be, Jana, I saw you flinch when either I or Robert mentioned that someone who's a lecturer instructor would say, I don't want to get non-reappointed. I know that that's, not something that's just going to happen out of willy-nilly, right?
That's why I flinched.
That's exactly. I wanted to pick up on that you picked up on that. And also, this is part of a piece here that's part of this and the larger picture, that it might be a result of quite a few communications across the university that have often language in it that speak about, but in the worst case scenario, blah, 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 disciplinary, blah, 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 including an up to termination, right? I know that's language that you guys use for various reasons from your side. And I know that, true or not true, that this can be perceived for folks who are lecturer instructors in a way that applies to them a lot more, and that is something that is hanging over them a lot more. The perception that even instructors who've been here for a long time, who might be associate or whatever, feel very, very vulnerable in their job security, therefore will agree to things that they're not good for the unit, for the job, etc. That's quite real, and that's not something that's an isolated phenomenon. So I just wanted to, and then we can move on here, notice that I noticed you're noticing, and just say, it's an issue. So we need to figure out a way on both sides to communicate the facts better there, and to also not, maybe watch better how we communicate some of these things so that doesn't... end up as this sort of helping bullying. I think you're next.
Piggybacking on this, right? My question is about the sort of sedimented tiering of faculty without significant mobility except at the upper level. You know, we've got these tiers of instructors and lecturers, right, who have a heavier, less valued role in the university and less well compensated because it's less valued. And then we've got the tiers of tenure earning through to full professor. And while there is some mobility from tenure track to tenured, that's really the only place where a lot of mobility happens on a fairly regular basis. And the difficulty, of course, is that the undesirable work flows downhill, always. Right? The dean needs some task done, the dean asks the chair asks the faculty, the senior faculty says, hell no, I'm already stretched too thin, I'm not doing that, and it flows down to the lecturers and instructors. Right? They do the heavy lifting on the teaching. Right? This also differs, not differs, but is exacerbated by in different disciplines, right? In terms of who's more teaching faculty, who's more research faculty, who's carrying what loads, who's getting compensated in what ways. So there's rank intersecting with discipline, right? And all of this intersects, right? And there's lots of national data around this, with gender and with race. Gender is the most obviously sedimented thing in terms of the ranks. Right? Female faculty are disproportionately represented amongst the contingent laborers. White men are disproportionately represented among the full professors. You know all this, Jenna. Right? So if we keep this layering sedimented and in place, right, the way it is, and we keep the workloads the way it is, where everything keeps flowing downhill, right, and where the most valued and most well-compensated labor is at particular ranks, and the least valued, but not thereby the least important labor, is at the bottom, we can't deal with the equity issues.
You know, I find this one really challenging. As a university, we're vastly better about contingent faculty than almost any university in the country, and it's one of the reasons we have a poor student-faculty ratio. It's obviously not the only reason. We use far fewer adjuncts than almost any, far below the norm for large public universities. And I always kind of proud of that as a dean that we were moving in that direction. And we did it, and the we was not really me, it was, you know, but it happened here by getting, you know, the instructor lecturer career tracks established and written into the collective bargaining agreement. There's as much mobility within them as there are within assistant professor to professor. There's no doubt about it, it's two separate faculty tracks. That's correct. We, you know, nationally, and sometimes I think when I listen to you, people use the word contingent for everything that's not tenured. There's a very big difference between being a lecturer with the protections that they have here, which are not the same as tenure, and somebody who's got six adjunct jobs trying to piece a living together that way. So I've always been kind of pleased with that. I mean, in a sense, in terms of equity, you know, it was like better, more decent treatment. There's no doubt that there's differences in pay, and you know, if value is equated to pay, then I accept your use of the word valuing the tenured faculty more. For me, that's always been a really basic place where higher ed intersects the free market system, meaning what you have to pay to get people qualified to do different things. Similar reasons why you know, on average, our faculty make more than public employees generally in the state. So I don't know what to say about that. I always, when I talk about faculty, I always mean all the faculty, and I really try hard to have others do the same thing. You know, it took a while for the Senate to give reasonable representation, I think, and I think they have now, although I haven't looked recently, for example, not distinguishing between ranks. I hope that's the case now. But there is culture. And that's, so culture is a part of this. Workload is a part of this.
What do you mean by culture?
We've got plenty of faculty here. And who, for reasons of careful thought about how a university should run, or just their sense of status, want to distinguish strongly between tenured faculty and all the non-tenure earning faculty. So we, you know, our colleagues, we have any number who strongly feel that the tenured faculty are the more valuable faculty institution, the ones whose voices should be heard, the ones whose opinion should carry weight. All right, I mean, their voices should be heard and their opinions should carry weight. That's also the case with our non-tenure earning colleagues. So that's what I mean by culture. It's not just the employment structure that we have. It's also the sense of higher ed. There's behind that, and I said it sometimes, I think just about status. I think, you know, those of us in faculty jobs are pretty status conscious as a group. I don't necessarily mean every individual. I mean, it's hard to get these jobs. It's taken a lot of work. We're not appreciation isn't shown the way it is in the business world by 30 years of promotions and increases in salary. Our sense of ourselves matters a lot, and sometimes that comes out in good ways or less good. All right, there's a good reason for some of it, which you guys have alluded to. You know, traditionally shared governance is strongly influenced by tenured faculty for all the reasons you just said, that they have a greater ability to speak their minds freely without fear of consequences. And so there's been a historical tendency for that to be the strongest voice in shared governance. But what you talked about was a couple different things. Stratification, which felt like social status, and work flowing down, which is not that, which is, it's associated with it, but it's really about, I think, what Cloudy was talking about, which is inability to say no, or a sense of vulnerability. I don't know what to do about the cultural status part, except to always try to project the fact that our faculty colleagues are all valuable, all doing different work towards the mission of the institution.
But isn't that the nature of a two caste system?
Yeah.
To say, we value you, but you have to teach twice as much and we're going to pay you half as much. And oh, can you direct that program too?
You know,
that's kind of like how two-class system works, right?
Yeah. I mean, there's a structural issue here that can't be solved by individuals.
I hear you, but I also don't think it's a structural situation that we're going to get out of.
Mm. Well, I mean, there are things one can do, right? I don't know that any of them are ideal, but I'll just throw out, you know, two things right now. One is something we used to have back in the day, which is there was a bridge from one to the other, right? You could go years and years ago from a non-tenured position into a tenured position. You could apply for that promotion, right? You did it at your own risk because now you're now on tenure track and you now have the 5 years to prove yourself, and right? So really it's only research active faculty that are gonna do that, but it was there. We don't have that bridge anymore. It's not a possibility. Which keeps them really separate, right? Whatever you're hired into is where you stay, regardless of how much research you're doing, right? We have faculty in my own department, and I'm sure I'm not alone, right, that are got hired in instructor or lecturer positions that have produced books and are very research active, more active than some of the people that got hired into tenure earning or tenured positions, right? So it's the luck of what job happened to be out there the year they were interviewing. It's not about what they do. So one thing that can be done is the bridge. The other thing is you're keeping it more sedimented, but you tenure. There's no reason that tenure only has to be for the assistant, associate, full professors. You could have tenured lecturers and tenured instructors.
Yeah, I don't see any chance of us expanding the tenure system to include those categories.
Why?
I think that's a bargaining issue, is it not, too?
Yeah,
probably. I'm not trying to bargain it. I'm responding to...
No, I hear you.
I don't see anything we can do about it. I'm throwing out two ideas that might be...
No, helpful. I hear it. That's turning, and I hear it. You know, it's a harder conversation probably than I want to get into today. But I just was being honest. I don't see any chance of that happening here in the state or really nationally as a change towards increased tenure in public universities. So it's I said it because I'm interested always in trying to figure out what we can do to help within the boundaries of where we're stuck. And that's why I said that. I feel that that's the situation we're going to be in. And so what can we do to help? I hear your point about the promotion. That's not the same thing as a global change. It's who can I change?
No, I agree. It's a different thing. Yeah. But it allows some degree of mobility for those who would like to move from a teaching-heavy career to a more research-heavy career. Well,
Shelley, could you help me understand that better? Because I would argue that the bridge exists. Mm-mm. Still.
No.
Well, you can apply.
You can apply, which is exactly what you said. They could apply.
No. This was what used to be the case was you could apply for a promotion from a lecturer position, or I guess they were all instructors at that point, from an instructor position to an assistant professor.
Okay.
You didn't have to wait until a job came open and then apply for it along with 200 other people.
So it was a conversion of that line to basically an assistant professor line, which means you have to be good at both teaching and research because you get promoted on one and then you get evaluated in the second. So actually,
and there was no guarantee that you'd get it, like any other promotion. You applied for it and maybe you get it, maybe you wouldn't. But
well, thank you for explaining it. I didn't understand that one.
Yeah. One other thing, quickly. The coach survey that we're doing, right, tied to this same issue of sedimented tiers, right? I noticed that when you break out the data, right, we're looking at the differences in responses, potential differences in responses for tenure earning and associate and full professors. We are not breaking out the data for instructors and lecturers, and I would be interested to see what the faculty satisfaction measures are on
it's
those
actually there.
Too.
It's the heading is NTT. That's the heading they use. That is because the way the survey is administered. So Harvard is the company. They do it. We don't actually. It's not our survey. It's their survey. But anyway,
I know.
The column is NTT because it's only instructors and lecturers in that column.
Mm-hmm.
They only want instructional faculty in the survey. So that is reflective of all.
Okay.
Instructors.
I guess it's just not in the synopsis.
No, I can give you the link or give to Charlie. There's a full report that you can manipulate and look at them all. I can tell you briefly that historically, that group of faculty has been much more satisfied. This past administration, less satisfied. And to some of the topics we've been discussing, the dissatisfaction is within the department and treatment within the department. That's where I see this stuff, but we'll get the link to Charlie to talk
about it. And that would make sense because they're swimming in a smaller pool.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, can you explain what you meant by this administration compared to?
We've done the survey three times. So the most recent time we did it, which was spring of 21.
Oh, so they weren't responding to the administration.
No, the survey.
You mean the administration
of the survey.
Survey,
yes.
Right?
Sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
I thought she meant me.
No, I was actually thinking Whitaker, I thought, because he started.
I defaulted to the survey link. Survey administration.
Okay, yeah,
yes.
I got it.
And then one other quick question, and then I we need to move along. Why the coach survey as opposed to the Here I survey?
No, that's a great question. Coach is used by a lot of universities like us, so a lot of research universities. I don't know how it started originally. I wasn't there for the first one. We've done it afterwards because we had a lot of comparative data every 3 years, which is nice. I took a quick look at the other survey. There are no real good comparators for us because a lot of the universities we take are smaller. And so I want to compare ourselves to similar kinds of universities to see where we're not this much smaller ones, which have different kinds of environments. They have different kinds of questions in the Harry survey, but the questions in the coach survey are very similar. They're pretty extensive.
Is there a...
There's a lot of stuff in the Harry survey, right, about satisfaction with particular parts of one's workload.
Yeah, and that's in the coach. There's different aspects of research, teaching, other aspects, service, yeah.
Is there an interpretive dance that happens between 4 and 5 on the agenda? Just go ahead.
No, I'm just going to leave.
All right, bye. Thank you very much, Robert. See you later.
Okay. Thank you, Robert.
Sorry.
Thank you.
I'm chairing a search at 11, so I got to go.
Oh, thank you, Dan.
Go on.
Bye.
Lee's still here, and Lee's on the program next, so
yep.
That's good.
I'm going to stay here, too. All right, as we wrap up, this should not take long. Thank you for inviting us to this meeting, and I appreciate the dialogue thus far. It's been very productive. Dr. Jonathan, I love what you said only 5 minutes ago, and I'm going to quote you directly. You said, academic freedom is the strongest feature of shared governance. Yes, and we certainly believe that. And so again, many of our concerns relate to HB7, and while we have specific questions here, we noticed that on October 6th, Nancy Myers, Director of ADA and Coordinator, she drafted a policy 2017. And much of the policy that is proposed here at UCF looks to be almost a replica of HB7 concepts and procedures and so forth. Although it may not be direct, it kind of like looks that way. And one of the more interesting, well, I'll get to that, but let me just get to the question first. Florida legislation affecting teaching research, any update on HB7 impact for new change policies? I guess this might be relevant, but even more so, how many complaints have been made to the university, if any? How have they been addressed? And what internal discussions are you having, and what steps are you taking to ensure that academic freedom is maintained in the face of the chilling effect of HB7? I think the chilling effect is something we can all kind of relate to, right? FAFSA concern, what can they say, what can't they say in class? There are a lot of scenarios that I crafted in my mind in the last 2 months or so, but one of them goes like this. In my classes, and perhaps in your class as well, we have students who give oral presentations on certain concepts and chapters, and the chapter has been espoused in a certain position. And you have a student standing before a class, and he or she is really hitting on a lot of points, and the class in MOS agrees with the student. But the problem with my scenario is that the student is mentioning many of the concepts that are forbidden within these policies and proposed regulations, yet the class, again, in mass, is gravitating towards those concepts and accepting them, you know, without argument. But one student in the audience disagrees with all of that. So the question is, how is that student either liable for violating the policy or not liable, where faculty can be accused of violating the same policy if they were to deliver the same lecture, if you will? So those are some of the things that have been, thought about. So, but yeah, just to get to some of the questions in general, beginning with the first one, has there been any new change policies with respect to HB7?
The one that you just mentioned is so the Board of Governors passed a regulation as the legislation required. The university passed a regulation last week.
Yes.
Board of Trustees approved a regulation, which is really very much like the Board of Governors regulation, which is modeled on the legislation. That's what you're seeing, is repetition of language. And then this policy follows that to try to talk about how we're gonna sort of implement it all.
Yeah.
So that's what's new. And the part of that that's probably most important is not really spelled out in that document. And we haven't spelled it out yet, really, is how are we gonna address it when a complaint comes along? Because the document talks about feeding it over to the academic affairs when there's a complaint about a classroom, and we have to settle on some mechanism to look at that. So far, we've had zero complaints, which is why this hasn't been more urgent in terms of structure on how we'll address it. I'm concerned about the chilling effect of the legislation.
Can I ask a question about the policy?
Please.
I don't have the entire law in front of me, but it seems to me that the UCF policy draft is adding things in excess of what's required in the Board of Governors policy. For example, and this may be my oversight, but for example, guest speakers are not actually, I mean, nobody had, that had never been mentioned, right?
Right.
So this is one example. I think there are a couple of things like that in there where whoever drafted the UCF policy draft is going beyond what is already the pretty awful other stuff there, which from our perspective, we're like, hey, why would you do that, right? And then two, this is so problematic on so many fronts, right? Because what are you supposed to do? You have a guest speaker come in, you're now supposed to send them, here is our fascist law, please abide by it. And if they still show up, for whatever reason, then you're supposed to interrupt them when they say something that is part of their, I mean, it's just not practical. I think you all probably see that. Why is it in there?
So I'm not crazy about that either. They'll have to, I think, I'll object to it in the comments. We'll see where it lands, but I don't understand why that's in there either.
Okay.
I heard that UF put it in their policy. I don't know why, though. Because the law really speaks about the instructor, right? What the instructor is doing in the classroom.
Right.
When the sponsor of the bill was speaking, when the lawyers were defending the bill in suits, they said things like, you can assign readings that raise particular viewpoints about these concepts. That's permissible.
Right.
Speakers can come in and talk about it. That's permissible. But, it has to be done in an objective fashion, a scholarly fashion. So that particular clause, I'm not crazy about either. There's probably others in there that I haven't figured out yet, Claudia. That is the reason, we're not a monolith. That is the reason these things get drafted and pop up for public comment.
Right. And the follow-up to Claudia's concern about the guest speakers, I can tell you on numerous occasions I've had guest speakers in my class in this state's attorney's office, Orange County Sheriff's Department, OPD, victim services, shelters, whether it's a safe house, Seminole. And they've all talked to our students in the domestic violence course. And Janet probably knows this better than others, is that a lot of the literature in domestic violence talks about male patriarchy. And they talk about male privilege. And many of these speakers are quick to tell you that 85% of violence is basically perpetrated by men on women. And I can also imagine a scenario where men are sitting in class with Professor Ross, week in, week out, this stuff about male bashing. I know what you're doing.
I know. I'm sorry I did this. I couldn't help myself.
Yeah,
it wasn't against you. It was against the student.
I know what you're doing. You're proposing this Duluth model that we all heard about, and we know what that's about, and we're just sick of hearing it. And a man in my class takes objection and says, you know what? This is wrong. In fact, as I look at the policy that was proposed, it violates the third premise. It says, and I quote, an individual's moral character or status as either privileged or oppressed is necessarily determined by his or her race, color, sex, or origin. Well, the male would object, because it's not.
He says
there's nothing of male privilege here. Women are just as provocative, just as instigatory, just as involved. There's not a preemptory strike in the name of self-defense. They are abusive. Get over it, Professor Ross. So how do we handle that?
Yeah, so the important statement is that's not forbidden by the law. And there's two things here that we've got to worry about. One is the law. And I have to make sure we uphold it. And if a faculty member really is teaching that men are necessarily
inherently
worse because of their gender,
right.
then that can be a problem. If they're talking about...
Well, okay, sorry, but...
So listen.
Yeah,
I won't do this as smoothly as you. But if you are teaching that it's an inevitable consequence of maledom, as opposed then that might run afoul of the law. And that's where I get worried, that we might have some faculty run afoul of the law. But I'm more worried, frankly, about the potential chilling effects,
right,
because if people teach the scholarly understanding of their disciplines, evidence, data is 100% safe, right? You just present it. Interpretations of the data, explanations based on the theories and methods of your discipline, presented in a scholarly fashion. That's what you're supposed to do in the classroom. Trying to persuade your faculty to believe what you believe, or more than that, insisting that they believe what you believe, is where you start to step across the law. You can require that they demonstrate they understand what you've taught about the scholarly findings of your discipline. You should do that thing. The law doesn't permit you to demand their, you know, their conversion of their hearts and souls. But so the law, in my mind, is less threatening than the chilling effect. What have we done? I don't know if it's been useful. Jan and I have gone around and talked to a fair number of departments and faculty on this topic, and usually it's listening to the examples of people that is the most, you know, illustrative. Mm-hmm. I really want you to continue to teach the course you're supposed to teach.
Right.
Show that data. Talk about the explanations as thought up, as worked out, as reasoned through from your discipline. What I've talked to some faculty about, having heard from others, is that sometimes it might be useful to frame those conversations in a way that you may or may not have in the past. What you're going to learn today is emotionally disturbing for some. It may challenge your sense of yourself and how you should be looked at in society. Please understand the purpose here is for you to both understand the facts about society and start to learn these scholarly explanations for why it may be occurring and these potential inventions. You know, the framing, which you may already do, might be more useful today than in the past. But the point I made when I've talked to the departments is that it's what this law is seeking to prohibit is something that I don't believe has occurred very much here, because we've always had the same students that we have now. And if students felt like they were being, you know, insulted because of race or gender, I think they're quick to complain. And we don't get a lot of those complaints coming out of your classes. And that's my comfort in this, that I don't believe our faculty violate law. And I have to, you know, then I slow down every time I'm talking about this, and told
you're
me not to
do
this,
again,
but every time at the end I do the thing you don't want, which is I have to acknowledge there may be cases where people do run afoul of this law, and if they come up, we'll have to address it, which I expect will mean understanding what they're doing and why and trying to help them find a different approach. All right, so we're trying.
I think one of the things that might be helpful, it's not going to solve the situation we find ourselves in, but it might be helpful, is if you talked with people who actually have this as their area of expertise. Because I think the way I feel, I'm going to be honest, Mike, when I talk about this with you, right, is you're really, really trying to understand where we're at and reassure us that we don't need to worry. But I feel like I'm getting advice on how to teach my expertise,
right.
And you would feel very odd, I think, if I said to you, I know there's this weird law, right, that says you need to teach the earth is flat. Mm-hmm. And that if you veer too much in the direction of teaching it as round, you know, you're going to be in trouble. And so I come to you and I say, well, here's all the ways in which you can try and soft pedal that, right? You're going to bristle because you're being asked to teach two sides of an issue where there are two sides.
On the flat, the up and down. Oh,
no. No, I do
right?
hear that.
So
I
don't think you understand sometimes that that's where we're bristling. Right.
Yeah.
It's an earth is flat kind of thing.
For us, it's an earth is flat sort of thing. You're telling me to throw out all of my training.
Well, I don't think I am. I really don't. You know, I do my best with my limited understanding. What I really believe is that if your teaching is based on the theories and methods of your discipline and it's presented in terms of evidence and reason that it's, and it's not proselytizing, then the law is okay with that. If you make it clear to your students and it, that you, in fact, where possible, present different scholarly interpretations. That doesn't mean you bring in a flat earther or the equivalent. You don't bring in nonsense into your classroom to demonstrate an, you know, some foolish both sides-ism. You know, I can't, and this is actually where I run into that part you don't like, which is saying, but I can't be sure in the end. You're going to help us understand. You're going to help not so much me, but one another understand. You know, how to do a job which is holds up your sort of your professional ethics and stays on the right side of the law. I don't think it's entirely easy, but I'm frankly more worried about the chilling effect, because for the reason I've already said.
Absolutely. We are too. And I think, right. You know, this also connects to what we talked about earlier, the contingent and tenured. I mean, I'm going to teach my class the way I think is right to teach my class, right? Yeah. Like whatever, but that's not the same if you're an instructor or lecturer, and you're faced with the sort of chilling effect of this. I know for a fact that a lot of them have rethought and rewritten their syllabi and this and that, and it's not because they were doing anything that was not entirely professionally valid, right? Diffusing the conversations, doing less controversial things. Oh, well, maybe we won't talk about race. We'll just talk about something else. And this doesn't serve our students well.
Right. I agree with that.
And you would also agree that it has a disparate impact on certain disciplines.
Oh, yes. Others, yeah, right? Of course it does.
With the language of the original bill, I looked at the word indoctrinate, and it's really impossible here at UCF, and I'll tell you why. The definition says it's a process of teaching a person or a group to accept a set of beliefs uncritically. Well, here at UCF, we teach all of us to be critical thinkers. So that can never happen here. We can never indoctrinate an audience if they're critical thinkers.
Said that, oh, I see. If we are.
And in fact, critical race theory is about teaching
exactly,
critical thinking.
Exactly.
Not if you ask wrong.
Exactly. Exactly. Sorry.
Yeah, I really struggled with this because, you know, Exactly. I can only reason by examples, and yet I know that I can't give examples that are good enough for anybody whose expertise this really is.
Did that go through the questions on here?
Yes,
I just wanted to make sure.
Yes, Charlie. Yep.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Thank you for your patience.
I think part of what would, just one last thing that would be really helpful, is not to just assume that nothing we do could run afoul of the law.
Yeah.
Because that is the position some of us are in.
Right. I've come out of some of these conversations a little worried that I've been too Pollyannish, because nor do I want to encourage people to not think about it, right?
I'll give you one final example. I had actually, when you said zero, I was happy that it didn't reach you, because I did have one student who went straight to the dean, because apparently that's what undergraduate students now do, to complain about my class in the first week of things, because, I don't know, there was something too political and stuff, and, you know, the dean kicked it back to the chair, and the chair, I guess the student actually showed up in the chair's office, and the chair talked him off the ledge, and, you know, it all worked out just fine. I had already written back to him a long email explaining, contextualizing, da-da-da, and it was probably just somebody who didn't know what he's talking about. It was fine, but it was the sort of thing that I noticed, right? I mean, I noticed the email that came, I really don't think I should know your political opinion. I'm like, you don't know my opinion. And I'm afraid to speak up in this class now. I'm like, well, maybe you should do the reading, because clearly you haven't. So, I mean, there are lots of things to respond to, and I helped him contextualize it. In that context, for me, it was just like,
here we go.
Here's my five-paragraph response to you, which I had somebody else look at before I sent, which I don't usually do for tone, and I don't actually really worry about this. Imagine somebody else getting that. And I don't really understand why students go to the dean, right? They probably don't know what a dean is. So they just go straight to the dean, who's annoyed, who sends it back, and you know. So it's like a lot of people involved with a lot of hackles going up. So I'm sure I'm not the only person who's had this occur, because people are sort of nervous about it. It probably didn't get all the way up to you, which is great, because there's not an actual complaint. It's just people
perceiving certain things. But it's in the air, and it's making people nervous. You know?
Yeah. This was in the air, but now there's this extra
concern. Yeah.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
That's why it's chilling.
Alrighty. Shall we turn off the recording then?
Sure, we can.
Yes.
We are done here. Thank you very much for
your
time and for the conversation.
For being here.